Monster Man, special episode, The Phoenix.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Brian, or perhaps I should say, Brian and Jocelyn. Jocelyn is in fact the one who suggested the topic of the Phoenix for this episode. So Brian and Jocelyn, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. If you'd like to be like Brian and Jocelyn, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to getting to choose a topic for your own special episode, you'll also get all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which we are taking a look right now at the gods and heroes of Hawaiian mythology. It's been very interesting. Okay. So the topic that Brian, or Jocelyn via Brian, has asked me to discuss is the Phoenix. And we have previously talked about the Phoenix, but it was about 200 episodes ago. So maybe time to revisit some of those sources. In Dungeons & Dragons, or AD&D, the Phoenix appears in Monster Manual 2, and we kind of struggled with it a little bit back in episode 233. So if you want to go back and listen to that one, you can. In it, I identify that one of the main problems is there kind of isn't really anything to do with the Phoenix. Phoenix feathers are valuable, but the Phoenix is like AC-3, has 20 hit dice, it has a bunch of spells, etc., etc. It's very, very powerful. And so it's unlikely that extremely high-level characters are fighting extremely powerful monsters just to get gold, particularly not the kinds of gold that we're talking about. It's not like infinitely valuable, it's just quite valuable. Maybe lower level characters might like scavenge a phoenix nest looking for dropped feathers, but this is a pretty weird thing to be doing with a creature that has so much mythic resonance. Now, when you think of the phoenix, you probably think of a fiery bird or bird-like being which is consumed in a fire and then reborn. But actually, the very earliest writings about the Phoenix don't include this at all. Although, you can start to see, I think, why the myth developed the way it did. Let me read you some of the original sources here. So this is from The Histories by Herodotus, Book 2. The translation is by Godley. This is from around the 5th century BC. There is another sacred bird, too, whose name is Phoenix. I myself have never seen it, only pictures of it. For the bird seldom comes into Egypt, once in 500 years, as the people of Heliopolis say. It is said that the Phoenix comes when his father dies. If the picture truly shows his size and appearance, his plumage is partly golden and partly red. He is most like an eagle in shape and size. Flying from Arabia to the Temple of the Sun, they say, he conveys his father encased in myrrh and buries him at the Temple of Helios. This is how he conveys him. He first molds an egg of myrrh as heavy as he can carry, then tries lifting it. And when he's tried it, he then hollows out the egg and puts his father into it, and plasters over with more myrrh the hollow of the egg into which he has put his father, which is the same in weight with his father lying in it. And he conveys him encased to the Temple of the Sun in Egypt. This is what they say this bird does. Myrrh, by the way, is a substance based on tree resin, so it's like a sap kind of substance. It was used for medical purposes in the ancient world, and it was also associated with funerals, which would make sense for why the body of the Phoenix's father is encased in myrrh. So you'll note that there's no reference to fire, other than, I guess, it goes to the Temple of the Sun, and the sun is a bit like fire. The color of the bird is golden and red. That kind of suggests fire, but there's no fire. And there's no mention of rebirth, although putting a dead body inside something shaped like an egg does kind of suggest that. So we can see how, you know, maybe Herodotus is relating a widespread belief, or later writers are reinterpreting the symbolism from Herodotus, because by the end of the kind of late antique period, I think the Phoenix as we know it. So I think the Phoenix as we know it exists by the 4th century AD. This is from a poem by the poet Claudian called The Phoenix. The translation is by Platonier, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It talks about how the Phoenix is getting old. Although he says it's when it's 1,000 years old, not 500. It says, "Now the phoenix's bright eye grows dim, and the pupil becomes palsied by the frost of years, like the moon when she is shrouded in clouds, and her horn begins to vanish in the mist. Now his wings, wont to cleave the clouds of heaven, can scarce raise them from the earth. Then, realizing that his span of life is at an end, and in preparation for a renewal of his splendor, he gathers dry herbs from the sun-warmed hills, and making an interwoven heap of the branches of the precious tree of Saba, he builds that pyre which shall be at once his tomb and his cradle. On this he takes his seat, and as he grows weaker, greets the sun with his sweet voice. Offering up prayers and supplications, he begs that those fires will give him renewal of strength. Phoebus, that's the sun, on seeing him afar, checks his reins, and staying his course, consoles his loving child with these words: "Thou who art about to leave thy years behind upon yon pyre, who, by this pretense of death, art destined to rediscover life, thou whose decease means but the renewal of existence, and who by self-destruction regainest thy lost youth, receive back thy life. Quit the body that must die, and by a change of form come forth, more beauteous than ever." So speaks he, and shaking his head, casts one of his golden hairs, and smites willing Phoenix with its life-giving effulgence. Now, to ensure his rebirth, he suffers himself to be burned, and in his eagerness to be born again, meets death with joy. Stricken with the heavenly flame, the fragrant pile catches fire and burns the aged body. The moon, in amaze, checks her milk-white heifers, and heaven halts his revolving spheres while the pyre conceives the new life. Nature takes care that the deathless bird perish not, and calls upon the sun, mindful of his promise, to restore its immortal glory to the world. Straightway, the life spirit surges through his scattered limbs, the renovated blood floods his veins, the ashes show signs of life. They begin to move, though there is none to move them, and feathers clothe the mass of cinders. He who was but now the sire comes forth from the pyre, the son and successor. Between life and life lay but that brief space wherein the pyre burned. His first delight is to consecrate his father's spirit by the banks of the Nile, and to carry to the land of Aegyptus the burned mass from which he was born. With all speed he wings his way to that foreign strand, carrying the remains in a covering of grass. Birds innumerable accompany him, and whole flocks thereof throng in airy flight. The mighty host shuts out the sky wherever it passes. But from among so vast an assemblage, none dares outstrip the leader. All follow respectfully in the balmy wake of their king. Okay, so that is the Phoenix, the king of the birds, which is an interesting piece of detail added there. And we also get an attempt to reconcile the resurrection story with the story given by Herodotus. And that is the Phoenix as it appears in Monster Manual 2. It is very much the Phoenix of late antiquity. Is the 4th century late antiquity? Sure, why not? And this image of the Phoenix persists pretty much throughout the Middle Ages. You can understand why the symbol was adopted by Christian writers. It's an image of death and of rebirth, which of course are major themes of Christianity, and even more, it's a creature where the son is also the father. So there are Christian writers who use this image of the Phoenix to talk about, you know, the death and rebirth of the Christian soul. Like, oh, you seem to die, but in reality, you're going to be reborn. And that is the image of the Phoenix that persists right into the modern day. So in the 19th and 20th centuries, there are lots of institutions that use a Phoenix as their symbol, and that is often to do with the idea of being reborn, you know, whether they mean that in a spiritual sense, or for example, the Phoenix is a symbol of the city of Coventry. Coventry was in large part destroyed during the Second World War. And so the idea is that Coventry will be rebuilt like the Phoenix rising from the ashes. And like I said, that is very much the Phoenix that we see in Dungeons and Dragons in its earlier editions. But there's kind of a problem with this, which is that the Phoenix doesn't translate very well to the experience of playing a fantasy game. Like, what do you do with it? Many of the monsters in the Monster Manual that come from classical mythology or classical literature are creatures that exist as antagonists, that are an obstacle in the way of a hero. So the Hydra, Chimera, the Sphinx, the Minotaur, like these are all monsters that are opposition of some kind, whether that's physical opposition like the Minotaur or mental opposition like the Sphinx. But that's not what the Phoenix does. The Phoenix falls into the category of a story about an exotic land, right? So Herodotus is just telling stories about the curious things that people from other countries believe. He's just, you know, enlightening people about myths and legends. The response that the reader is supposed to have to this story of the Phoenix is, huh, what a curious belief. Or, I bet this symbolizes this. But that's an emotion that's very hard to, and I don't know what the point would be, translate to role-playing games. So in his email, Brian asked about the idea that the Phoenix is more often represented in modern games as an elemental creature. And he mentioned the idea of the Phoenixes in Warhammer. So I don't know what it's like in Age of Sigmar. I didn't really play a lot of late Warhammer Fantasy Battle, but my understanding from Warhammer Total War 3 is that the Phoenix, which is part of like the High Elven, that'd be in Warhammer Total War 2. Anyway, whatever. The Phoenix is very much just like a creature of fire. It can do like bombing runs on enemy formations where it drops flamey bits. But there's also Phoenixes that are not. There's an ice elemental Phoenix. So this is a Phoenix that is being thought of primarily as an elemental creature. Now, I think, again, that that's a challenge of translating lore into the game on the table, right? Because in Warhammer Fantasy, the High Elves are ruled by the Phoenix King, right? There's that duality between the Phoenix King and the Everqueen. And, you know, one of their elite regiments are the Phoenix King's personal bodyguard, the Phoenix Guard, who I don't know if they're based on the ones from the Stephen Bruce books, who I guess are also the Imperial Bodyguard, right? It's been a long time since I've read those books. But they don't have a Phoenix. And as Warhammer came to be more and more dominated by big models and big monsters, giving the more like human-scale armies monstrous creatures, especially ones like the High Elves, where they don't really do war machines. It's not really their thing. You know, there's only so many dragons they can have. Who's the guy who rides around on a hippogriff, a griffin, Eltharion the Grim? Anyway, those guys. But, you know, eventually you want to have some more monsters, and I guess they had these phoenixes. But making them elemental is, again, kind of like, how do you translate? You know, the point of the Phoenix King is supposed to be that it represents the continuity of the rulers of Ulthuan, right? Like the old one dies and a new one is born, rather than he has fire powers or whatever. But if you're going to make it a unit that's got to fight in a war game, then it has to have some kind of power. So I guess elemental powers. And this is not just true in Warhammer. I went and looked at the 5th edition of Phoenix, which is in Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes. And as I was flipping through it, I couldn't find it. And eventually I had to look it up. And I said to my wife, you know that in this book, Phoenix is under E? And she said, yeah, for it's a bird. But what it actually is for elemental. Like the Phoenix is listed under elemental creatures, like it's a salamander, like it's whatever. So the whole deal of it now is that it is a creature of fire. Now, I wonder if part of this is the association between the Phoenix and the Feng Huang. The Feng Huang is a bird from Chinese mythology, Chinese folklore, Chinese art, that is often referred to as a phoenix, even though it doesn't really have very much in common with a phoenix, but it is kind of red. It's vermilion in color, and it is associated with heat because it's the animal associated with the direction of the south. So it's sometimes called a phoenix, I guess, the idea being that it is fiery. It is not in any other way phoenixy. It's not even really fiery, it's just warm. And I do wonder if the association of the Phoenix as like primarily a creature of fire is to do with something else that he mentioned in his email, which is, of course, the Phoenix from Marvel Comics. So if you're not familiar with the Phoenix from Marvel Comics, I'm absolutely not going to go into the whole story here because it's extremely complicated. And also, I haven't read very many of the comics about it written in like the last 30 years. But the character Jean Grey, Marvel Girl, at one point apparently dies and then comes back to life. And as a result of this, changes her name to Phoenix, right? So there, the Phoenix is the image of death and rebirth. But it becomes clear that like this has increased her powers, but also that she's kind of struggling to control them, or perhaps that she's maybe getting a little too excited about her powers. And eventually she becomes Dark Phoenix, an antagonist who has to be I was going to say who has to be killed, by which I mean there was an editorial mandate that the character had to die because of, like, it would be inappropriate for her to continue as a member of the team after the terrible things she had done. However, fans liked the character and the writers liked the character, and so eventually, and there's a whole backstory to this, like, of what's going on behind the scenes, of fan theories and proposals, and a very young Kurt Busiek, but the deal is that they eventually decided that the Phoenix was a separate entity from Jean Grey, and so Jean Grey could be brought back without the stain of the Phoenix's crimes on her. And so there was a whole rigmarole, but eventually she came back from the dead. So this then gave Marvel the ability to have the Phoenix Force kind of exist as a character, and it could, like, bond with other people and give them Phoenix-y powers. But what that meant a lot of the time was kind of fire powers. And the image of the Phoenix as a firebird, a shape made of fire, you know, in this case, it's a being that's sort of composed of energy. So naturally, that's sort of what it looks like. That, I think, did come to affect how people think of the Phoenix, particularly people within that kind of geek culture space who would be more influenced by what's going on in comics, even if they don't necessarily read them themselves. So I do think that that's part of it, but I also think that part of it is just a response to a game design problem, which is that the Phoenix is such a well-known creature that you have to include it, or you're going to get people writing in going, where's the Phoenix? But it's not that gameable. So in order to make it a monster in your game, you have to kind of change it up a little bit. You know, Monster Manual 2 proposes a D&D-able Phoenix, but it's obviously an unsatisfying solution because the later versions don't look very much like that. This is another thing that Brian mentioned in his email, and I think that this is a good idea. When you have a creature whose role is primarily symbolic, then it makes sense to treat that creature not as a monster, but as something else. The Phoenix could be a deity or a deity-like being in your setting. There's ample precedent for characters having kind of animal or non-human deities or spirits, and in fact, having some monster deities. I mean, phoenixes are intelligent. You know, there's no reason that they couldn't have a god. Or indeed, the phoenix, the one, could be a god. Brian mentioned the idea, which I like naturally, that having monstrous or non-human deities would kind of help take humans out of the center of the fantasy setting, assuming that that's something that you want to do. Some people are very big on humans being in the center of their fantasy settings. So I think that you could do this, and in fact, I think you could do this for a lot of creatures from myth. You know, I do think that it's a harder challenge to get people to care very much about a beholder god or a hook horror god or anything else that exists solely within the context of D&D. And I think that historically, like, orc gods and whatever have been not very interesting because they have just tended to be, you know, who's the biggest orc of them all. Although, actually, some later interpretations of Grooms are quite interesting. But I think, you know, you could take the Phoenix, the Sphinx, the Hydra. You could get a dragon in there. If you wanted to go, like, outside of things known to Greek mythology, you could have a kraken. Krakens are not a mythical creature, really, but you know what I mean. They have taken on that idea because of their associations with powerful images that we already have in our minds of the cold, dark sea and the tentacles rising up and so on. So that would give it some extra resonance. In fact, if you had a phoenix deity and then you had phoenixes, that would give the phoenixes something to do, right? They'd be out there embodying the deity's principles of death and rebirth and renewal. But then when you met one, instead of thinking, oh yeah, I bet those feathers are worth a good 50 GP each, you could think to yourself, the sacred animal of a god, look at how it embodies the magical process that keeps the world being reborn, or whatever. It raises a lot of interesting questions, you know. What are the clerics and paladins of the Phoenix like? Are they the ones who strive to rebuild the world that has been burnt? Civilization got destroyed, but they're the ones who help it rise from the ashes? Or are they the ones doing the burning? You know, do they believe that you must destroy in order to renew, just as the sacred phoenix is consumed by fire when it's become worn out? Do they look at a culture or a city or whatever and think, you know, this has become decadent, we need to burn this down so that something new may arise in its place? You know, both perfectly good interpretations of the myth of the Phoenix, if you assume that the Phoenix is a deity that has all these D&D deity things, clerics and paladins and what have you. Brian also suggested that, like, recent issues, I say recent, it's a good few years ago now, of the Mighty Thor have posited the Phoenix Force as a deity, so that the cosmic Marvel stuff interacts with Thor, and so, you know, the Phoenix Force is a deity that the Norse gods can interact with. So, you know, can you have a pantheon, which is based on that kind of cosmic Marvel setting, you know, that there'd be people out there who are clerics of Galactus, for instance. Now, immediately the mind rebels because I have always held that the superior pantheon is the cosmic DC pantheon. But the reality is that cosmic Marvel and cosmic DC are probably more interchangeable than any other parts of those two comics universes. You know, connecting cosmic Marvel and cosmic DC makes a lot more sense than any of Marvel's attempts to create a Superman analog, like the Sentry or whatever, and the majority of DC's attempts to create a Spider-Man analog. Although, I will say that Jaime Reyes, the Blue Beetle, is clearly a Spider-Man analog and a pretty good character. But the cosmic stuff overlaps to a large extent, mainly because it's mostly created by the same people. So, most obviously, Jack Kirby, right? The guy who created Galactus also created the New Gods. And then the people who followed in his footsteps also worked for both companies, right? So, you know, Jim Starlin he wrote Cosmic Odyssey, didn't he, over at DC? But then obviously he's done a lot of Cosmic Marvel stuff. Walt Simonson did that epic run on Thor that introduced characters like Beta Ray Bill, but also he did an Orion series for DC, etc., etc., right? So the creative talent kind of goes back and forth between the two companies, but particularly I think in the cosmic field. You could take, I don't know, the Omega Men out of cosmic DC, and they could turn up and hang out with the Guardians of the Galaxy, and it would all make perfect sense, right? Just replace the Dominion with the, I don't know, who are the bad guys these days? The Shi'ar. The Shi'ar are a great example, right? The Shi'ar Imperial Guard, who play a big role in the Dark Phoenix saga, are analogs to or parodies of DC characters. Their leader, Gladiator, his name is Clark. Anyway, whatever. So I'm a big comics nerd, and I don't want to get too much into the details of it, because if you're not one, then most of this won't mean anything to you. But I think that it's not hard to say, you know, these are cosmic powers. Cosmic powers are, you know, what humans view as gods. And if you have the right table, I think people could get on board with that. I think that for all that I am that guy, I don't know that there are that many players in my groups who would respond well if I said, you're going to be a cleric of the Phoenix Force, because not because they would think it wasn't serious, although they might, but because that doesn't have any resonance for them. They don't have a feeling about the first time that they read the Dark Phoenix saga. So you have to know your audience. If I were playing in a game and someone said, okay, here's the cosmology. A long time ago, heaven and hell were at war, and the leader of the good deities, Isaiah the Inheritor, offered a truce to his rival, Uxas. I would be like, heck yes, I want to play a cleric of Scot-Free. I'd be all for it. But that might not mean something to anybody else. I was going to talk about the pact, you know, the explanation for where the sons of these two deities wound up and how they got to be who they are. But, and I'm being 100% honest here, I did not think I could get through the story without crying. Now you might say, that's some silly stuff to get upset about, James, but you know, it has that mythic resonance for me. Because of what I read and when I read it, you know, the age that I was at, that stuff imprinted on me in a very profound way, but maybe not for everyone else. So some people wouldn't get it at all, and they'd probably be okay with it, right? They'd just be like, oh yeah, this dark side character, I mean, I guess he's kind of the devil, right? And they'd be fine with it. And some people would be, you know, diehard comic heads, and they would say, I can't wait to play what anti-paladin of Darkseid. Darkseid is. But then there'd be these people in the middle, and I think that they would say, what, like the guy from that Justice League movie? You actually can't see this, but I'm just making a big thumbs down gesture. You know, they wouldn't be moved by it. So one of the things about figures from certain mythologies, and there are cultural biases that cause this to be the case, but from certain mythologies, Greek mythology, Norse mythology, is that within the kind of Anglophone world, they are recognizable and everyone agrees that they are important. And for all that, like, I am fascinated by the introduction of other mythologies into D&D, a lot of the time you first have to teach people what they are so that they'll get your references, which feels, you know, if you put Kuwaha'ilo in your game, it's gonna read as exotic to the majority of Anglophone players. And I don't think that should be the case, but it is. So this is a very long-winded way of saying that you got to know your table. But I do think that it's true. I mean, I think the Phoenix is probably an exception because you can take those like Marvel Comics Phoenix elements and just put them into your regular mythological Phoenix, and they won't really clash with the other images. The idea of burning out, of you know, even you could add like an Icarus thing, right? A flying too close to the sun. The idea that like fire is a metaphor for hubris, those all make perfect sense with how we already think about these images. It feels like it fits naturally. And so that's something that I think would be pretty straightforward to do. Well, I managed to not get through another special episode without talking about DC Comics of my youth, but I did manage to get through it without talking about Glorantha. So I think everyone should be proud of me for that. But Brian and Jocelyn, I hope that you both enjoyed this episode, and I hope that you found something that might be useful in it. Everyone else, please remember that if you'd like to be like Brian and Jocelyn, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. I mean, in this specific respect. In our next episode, we'll be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition, and we are going to take a delayed look at the main scorpion, plus as many other monsters as I can do in the time that I have. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.